current state on 90.5 WKAR. Early tomorrow morning, the Lansing area temperature could very well be in the single digits. In 5 days, we've got the first pitch of the Tigers' 2014 home opener against the Royals. It got me to wondering whether opening day attendance just might not be what we're accustomed to. You know, beer sales may be down a little bit next Monday at the ballpark. Admittedly, it will be warming up, though. Sunday's high is forecast to hit 54 here in Lansing. So who knows? Later this hour, current state contributor Gary Wilson on with our Great Lakes Month in Review segment. At the top of our program today, after close to 10 years in office, Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero enjoyed a first last night, the chance to submit a city budget plan with a surplus. Despite being slightly in the black for fiscal year 2015, Mr. Bernero describes his $118 million spending plan as conservative and cautious, reflecting concern with hundreds of millions of dollars in long-term unfunded obligations. The mayor wants to pre-fund more retiree health care. He also wants to earmark more for the city's rainy day fund in an effort to boost the city's rating with credit agencies. But money is also earmarked for public safety, a new ambulance, and new gear for Lansing firefighters. The mayor also wants to upgrade the city's technological infrastructure to the tune of $2.2 million. Here to respond to Mayor Bernero's spending plan, Carol Wood of the Lansing City Council. Welcome back.
Thank you.
We also want to point out that current state did reach out multiple times to City Council President Aileen Bowles to join us. She did not respond. Mayor Bernero calls this spending plan cautious and conservative. Do you agree with that description, and do you agree with a cautious conservative approach?
I think when we look at where we've been and the fact that we're only talking about 2.5% increase in revenues, that yes, we do need to be cautious about any budget that we put forward. I think it's extremely, though, important to make sure that what we are funding are services that have an impact on the quality of life, in not only encouraging people to move into Lansing, but those that are here to continue to reside here. And I think that's part of what we need to look at as we're dealing with this budget.
Well, so far, what do you think? Does this budget reflect that as a priority?
Well, somewhat. There are some things in here that I see that in a first blush that make sense, and then there are some things that I don't see in here that I wish I had. Code compliance is extremely important to neighborhoods and has, again, deals with quality of life issues. And when you look at the amount of housing that are vacant and dilapidated in our community, adding an additional code compliance officer, I would have liked to have seen that in this budget. Doesn't mean that that might not be a recommendation that comes from council as we move forward. Of course, sustaining our police force is extremely important. You know, one of the things when we received the federal grant to preserve officers, we were told through attrition that those 11 officers that we retained, that the when it came time for the city to start funding, it would meld into that. Now what we're doing is setting aside from the police millage around $400,000 to pay for that. So, you know, there's questions in there as to positions that we currently have open in the police department. Are they going to be filling those, not filling those? I mean, a lot of this is the devil's in the detail.
Hmm. Well, the mayor wants to line up. So do you see any significant dialogue emerging from your point of view with the administration over say another code compliance officer?
And this is part of the process that council goes through. Once we receive the budget, then it's a matter of looking at some of the priorities that we've set as a council to determine what we believe is important that might not have made the budget. are there ways to make changes in here? And then we take it out to the public, we listen to what the public has to say, and then we come back with a plan that is voted on by council and submitted to the mayor. The mayor has the ability to do a line item veto. He could accept all but one item. He could accept none of the items like he did with last year's, with the current budget that we're in, and veto all of those. So, you know, again, this is a process, and getting more details as to exactly what we're talking about is important. I know, again, doing a first blush of this, it's important that the fire department have ambulances. It's important that they have turnout gear. Where they're getting that revenue from is from the fire millage. Is that what we told people that we were going to use those dollars for? You know, we told them it was for boots on the ground. So does this accomplish it by providing them the equipment without making sure that we've got enough to make sure that we're paying for the firefighters? And so those are all questions that we'll be working through during this budget process.
How do you think your constituents would feel about one more code compliance officer working for the city? Would that resonate with your constituents?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the neighborhoods are the heart and soul of the city, and much of what we see, again, as we're looking at the value of property, if you have a house next door to you that's run down, not being taken care of, that's red tagged, those are issues. It makes a difference when somebody's driving down the block and sees a house for sale and sees that next to it. Are they going to invest in our community? And that's part of what we continue to wrestle with and work with, and making sure that we have more enforcement out there to deal with those issues are extremely important. When I started on council, we had an increase code compliance. At one time, we had over 9 code compliance officers along with seasonal code officers. We're down to 5 now. So we know the housing stock hasn't changed. We haven't torn down that many houses. We haven't annexed part of Lansing. We still have that same geographic area. But if anything, we have more code issues that need to be dealt with. And one of the things that we have done as a council is adopted the International Property Maintenance Code that allows us to look at commercial buildings as well. And that's something that we've not honed in on.
The mayor also wants to assign $1.5 million in existing millage money to city street repairs and $370,000 to sidewalks, but he stresses the road investment is minuscule compared to what's needed and urged the state to step up. Any response to that?
You know, I echo that cry. Sitting on Tri-County Regional Planning and seeing from a Tri-County area what we're dealing with and the amount of money that we see coming into us to be able to maintain and to rebuild roads, we just do not have enough coming in. We've got to make sure that the legislature comes up with a plan that allows local municipalities to have more dollars to fix these streets. Again, you know, quality of life. If I drive down a street that I've got to go through canyons to get to my house, I'm making a choice on whether to live there or not, no matter how nice the house is or how good the school district is. All of those things make a difference when you're looking at purchasing homes.
Yesterday afternoon, Mayor Bernero told us that until the state takes action, the possibility exists that lanes with potholes may simply need to be closed in Lansing. Do you share that concern?
I would like to understand what his plan is for that and to have a better understanding. You know, right now, we watch motorists, even with bike lanes that do not adhere to the law, let alone how you would barricade off a lane to make sure that people weren't driving on that based on the fact that it needed to be reconstructed. Those are all, again, huge issues that we as a municipality and a state need to wrestle with.
We're talking with Lansing City Councilperson Carol Wood here about Mayor Brunero's proposed fiscal year 2015 budget. The mayor's promoting the importance of beefing up the rainy day fund. He wants the council to join him in an effort to get it up to 12% of the general fund budget. He proposes $500,000 toward that in fiscal year 15. Are you on board with that?
Again, I think it's important. Was on council when Mayor Hollister started the rainy day fund and setting surplus dollars aside. And whether that number of $500,000 is what we look at or whether it's something a little bit less than that, again, it's looking at what the priorities are out there.
But would you put up another code compliance officer ahead of the rainy day investment?
Well, and again, I look at code compliance because of the fees that they charge for their service to be able to pay for itself. That's a little bit different than maybe adding a staff person. This person should generate enough money to pay for their position as a code officer. Filling that hole with a rainy day fund, it's what it's for. It's when we have those problems with budgets and revenues coming in, unexpected things that we're dealing with, just like we dealt with this winter with the snow and so much of it. That's why that rainy day fund was created, and we do have to look at trying to make sure that we are putting money back in that.
We'll continue to watch the discussion unfold with regard to the budget. While you're here, I did want to ask you about the community review team. Where are you regarding General McDaniel's review, the community review team's review of the Board of Water and Light?
My understanding, the next step is to have specialists come in to the review team and talk about their expertise as they look at what happened with the Board of Water and Light. There are times that I and I think some of the public have been frustrated with the information and how it's gotten to the review team and some of the things that I think we would have thought as a organization that they would have done better during a crisis management of keeping records and making sure that those were supplied in a timely manner. I know that there were several requests by the media to find out exactly what the cost was to the board, and it wasn't until just recently at a Joint Committee of a Whole and Board of Water and Light meeting that we got that figure that the storm cost $4.5 million as a result of that. So I think, you know, again, I think there's a little bit of frustration on making sure that we're getting all the information in a timely manner. And I appreciate all the efforts that the review team has done to this point and looking forward to what their conclusions are.
Carol Wood is a longtime member of the Lansing City Council. Many thanks for joining us today,
Thank
Carol.
You.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. At the end of each month, we check in with Great Lakes commentator and journalist Gary Wilson for updates on environmental stories from around the basin. For today's Great Lakes Month in Review, we're focusing on shipping tar sands oil in the region and Great Lakes Day, which took place recently in Washington, D.C. Gary Wilson, welcome back to Current State.
Hey, Mark. Good morning. And before I start, I have to tell you that the Chicago media has really jumped on the Michigan State basketball bandwagon. So they've got them in the Final Four. Final Four is a lock and championship likely. So the pressure coming from the other side of the lake.
They've gone green.
Yes.
In Chicago.
We have no we have no teams in the tournament here, so
you have no choice.
Well, I think they see what they see they like, and who knows what'll happen when the ball's tossed in the air. But they're all over Michigan State.
We're reassured to hear that. Well, let's talk about tar sands oil again. There has been quite a bit of talk about this. This is not the first time you and I have talked about tar sands oil on the Great Lakes. Remind us, first of all, what tar sands crude oil is.
Well, it's the tar sands crude oil, exactly that. It's the thick, heavy stuff that's being extracted from the plains of Alberta and the northern Canada and the northern plains of the United States. It's this thick, gooey stuff that some would say is going to give us energy independence, but it comes with a lot of baggage, and the big fear that is that if it's shipped on the Great Lakes and there's an accident, which at some point there probably will be, despite best efforts, is that it's really hard to clean up. It's different from regular crude oil because it sinks, and that's what's got everybody's attention here.
None is being shipped right now.
None's being shipped on the Great Lakes right now. It's flowing through pipelines and via rail cars, but it's not being shipped on the Great Lakes now. But what's generating a lot of interest in the last few weeks are two environmental groups, one Canadian, the Council of Canadians, and one in the U.S., the Alliance for the Great Lakes here in Chicago, have both released reports, significant reports, calling into question the need to do this and generating awareness about the risks associated with rail pipeline and tanker shipments on the Great Lakes. A lot of hard questions are being asked.
And where on the lakes would tar sands oil, tar sands crude, be shipped if it did unfold?
Well, it's going to be all over the Great Lakes. It starts in Lake Superior, but it would definitely be coming to the Marathon plant in Detroit and down Lake Michigan to BP refinery here in Northwest Indiana, but through the Detroit River and points east. The demand is there, and the refiner's got to find a way to fill it.
And just the work involved in cleaning up a spill is their primary concern?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. The Canadians, the Council of Canadians, they want an outright ban on tar sands crude shipments. Canadian environmental groups tend to be a little bit more traditional, and they kind of stay in their role to work diligently for the environment, and they just want an outright ban on the shipments. The Alliance for the Great Lakes in the U.S., the U.S. groups tend to be a little bit more conciliatory or wanting to play the inside game. They're just trying to make sure that the Coast Guard and the shipping industry and everybody involved has assessed the risks appropriately and have viable plans in place if and when there are an accident. So two different approaches. Neither one's right or wrong. It just depends on your viewpoint.
Now, is this a debate, Gary, that's going to continue to play out over a longer period of time, or have we reached a point where Michigan is closer to a decision, an actual decision, on what its relationship to tar sands crude might be?
Well, I think the answer to both questions is yes. I think this debate's going to go on for quite a while. But I think the consensus, at least in the United States, is the product will be shipped, so how can we be best prepared and minimize the risk of an accident? I think that's what's going to happen in the States. Now, the Canadians, they've got their perspective, and they're a significant voice.
The annual Great Lakes Day in Washington, D.C. took place during the first week of March. What were some of the biggest topics of discussion, and was there anything notable for being overlooked?
Well, the Great Lakes Day in D.C., organized by the Great Lakes Commission, takes place every year. The biggest topic there is this is a cheerleading festival, and I mean that in a good way. It's rally the troops, go to D.C., lobby, and the biggest thing that they lobby for is money for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which we've talked about and always gets a lot of scrutiny. What's curious to me is the topic that wasn't discussed, and that is the algae problem, the Lake Erie algae problem. That's not a money issue. The International Joint Commission just released its final report saying the program's in place now, are clearly failing. That's a quote. The programs are clearly failing. And as the group gathered in Washington to lobby politicians, this just didn't really get much attention. And it's one of the three biggest issues identified by the U.S. EPA as critical to the Great Lakes region and to the ultimate survival of Lake Erie. So, but it's a hard one. That's why it's difficult to take on. But I also say it's the elephant in the room. If you're not talking about it when you gather in Washington, boy, that's tough to understand.
And we run up against agricultural interests when it comes to really seriously addressing algae in Lake Erie, do we not?
We do, and the agricultural lobby and the industry is very powerful, and people pay attention to them because they feed us. So they would prefer a continuation of voluntary measures, and the International Joint Commission report says that those aren't working. We've got to do something else. So however it plays out, when we gather, we at least have to talk about it and put it on the top of the list.
And the algae problem, I think there's consensus here, the algae problem is triggered by the runoff of phosphorus and other agricultural chemicals into the lake. In the case of Waukesha, Wisconsin, their request to divert water from the Great Lakes, we've seen how difficult this process has been. How might Waukesha relate to the future of Great Lakes water being sold off?
Well, Waukesha is the test case. You know, there was an op-ed in the Detroit News here a couple weeks ago by Dale Buss, who writes for Forbes magazine, the headline was, Should Michigan Turn Its Water Into Money? And he's getting at the topic of using water as a driver for the economy. Now, that means different things to different people. But part of it is generated by the drought conditions in the West. Will there be a day when the West comes knocking for Great Lakes water? I don't know if they will or not, but it's certainly a possibility. And related to Waukesha, Waukesha is the test case for that. If we get a real tough review of Waukesha's request, that could put a damper on some of these potential requests coming down the road in years or decades for Great Lakes water. If Waukesha gets a light review and kind of gets a pass, that's only going to fuel the interest from some of these drought-stricken regions to say, hey, these guys got all that water. We feed them. The parts of California provides, you know, about 95% of certain vegetables to the whole country. So I think their case might be, we're feeding them. We should be able to have access to some of their water. Waukesha's the test case, and we'll see how that goes.
Once a month, we review environmental news from around the Great Lakes Basin, and Gary Wilson helps us with that. Gary is a Great Lakes commentator and journalist. Gary, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. This Thursday evening, WKAR's Community Cinema event will feature a preview of the film Medora. This documentary tells the story of a struggling Indiana basketball team. Earlier this year, Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Davey Rothbart, one of the film's co-producers, and director Dylan McSolley, a former Medora High School basketball player who is featured in the film. And since we're that much closer to the actual airing of the movie on Community Cinema, Emmanuel is back to remind us and tell us more about Medora.
Well, for anyone who's ever played a sport anywhere, parts of this film are absolutely painful.
Are you kidding me? Well, my assumptions were right. You had no points. Zero. 0 points in the fourth quarter. Zero.
That was the Medora High School boys basketball coach venting to his team in the locker room after another loss. And as you can imagine from that clip,
ouch,
they lose a lot in Medora. It was the team's 0-22 record that drew the filmmakers Davey Rothbart and Andrew Coyne to the teeny town. But the film Medora goes beyond the court. It also focuses on the struggles of the players and the community and documents the value of vanishing small towns in America. I spoke with co-producer Davey Rothbart and Dylan McSolley, who's a player who is featured in the film. Davey explains why one resident in the film describes the town of Medora as closed.
Medora, you know, was once a flourishing small town with two thriving industries. They had a brick plant and a plastics factory. Both have closed in the last 10 to 20 years. And, you know, it was a town of over 2,000 people, and now that population has dwindled to under 500. So they've got one bank, one bar, one liquor store, one gas station. That's about it. It's a no-stoplight town. And it's really, it's emptied out. As the one thing they've been able to do is hold on to their school. And a lot of similar-sized communities around the state and around the country have lost their schools to consolidation. Mm-hmm. Medora has managed to hold on to their school, and it's the community identifies with this school and its high school basketball team.
Dylan, can you expand a little bit about why the school is so important to Medora?
It's important because there's so much, like, the people there love basketball, and their parents have went there, their grandparents went there, their great grandparents went there, and they'd like to see their kids graduate from the same school that they went to.
Davey, how did you end up there? How do you end up in the middle of Indiana?
Definitely. 4 years ago, me and Andrew Cohn, who directed the film with me, a longtime friend of mine, we read an article in the New York Times by a guy named John Branch. And it was about, you know, this dwindling rural town in southern Indiana, Medora, Indiana, and its high school basketball team, the Medora Hornets, who had gone 0-22 the previous season, had only won a handful of games in the previous 10 years. And Andrew and I drove down the next day to check out the town from our home in Ann Arbor. And, you know, we just met some of the players and the coaches, got to walk around the town a little bit. And at the end of the night, we just looked at each other and we were like, we have to make a film about this town and this team. You know, it's the film we were born to make. Mm-hmm. We're basketball nuts. We met on a basketball court in Ann Arbor growing up. And we're passionate documentary film junkies. And we just felt like there was some really important stories to be told here. And some very compelling stories. And the kids, you know, even from that first meeting at a basketball practice, you know, on our first visit, they had this vulnerability, this tenderness, and this real openness to share their stories with us. And it just seemed like, you know, it would to move to this small town was, it might sound weird to our friends in L.A. and New York.
Yeah, you dropped everything and moved there.
Yeah, but it, you know, it was a dream project for us. And it was rewarded through, you know, we're happy with how the film came out, but also just building friendships with and relationships with the players and mm-hmm. their families, people like Dylan McSolley and his teammates. You know, it was profound. We fell in love with the community, with these kids in particular, and, you know, anyone that sees the film is going to fall in love with them too, because, you know, they're just such courageous and resilient kids who have some pretty serious struggles that they've dealt with in their home lives and on the basketball court as well. But you see them find a way to overcome, and it's inspiring.
Dylan, speaking of, you know, intimate moments and personal stories, you really share a lot of yourself in this film, a lot about your father, and you've never met him. What was it like to watch that and see that after the fact?
Watching, like, when I met my dad, it's like I met him again. And again and again. But I guess I was just glad to finally meet him.
Dylan, you said some nice things during one of the Q&As this past week about how you were able to open up about such personal moments in your life. You know, these are some very private things that you have been through and experienced. You know, how were you able to talk about those things with the camera rolling and, you know, talking to Andrew and I?
Yeah, me and Rusty both talked about that in New York, and Davey and Andrew both, they opened up to us about their life when they grew up, mm-hmm. and that kind of brought, like, trust and respect, so we opened up to them, like, they earned our trust, and that's how they really got our story out, I think.
Was it healing for you, that experience, to share those moments?
Yeah, it actually was, because it actually helped me open up my eyes and like get it, let go of my past. Helped me talk about it with someone that actually lived sort of the same way, and it just helped.
I want to talk about basketball a little bit. I'm a basketball player myself, played a year in college, went to a school that I don't know. I don't think we won a game for 2 years or something like that. So I very much can relate to the painfulness of playing on a team and the frustration of that. Talk to me, Dylan, a little bit about what it was like playing on that team.
Well, all of us, we just got sick and tired of losing. People were expected us to lose. It's like when we came, they're like, oh, this is going to be an easy game. But we really never gave up. We did give a fight. Like, we would be down by, like, 30. We came back, and then we'd always have one bad quarter. But when we finally won that game, it's like we got that monkey off our back, and we actually won a game right after that. So it was very happy to see them win and us win. So, and the community was happy, and it just felt like we did something right for once.
And Davey, for you filming this, you know, and watching it, it harkens back to those great sports films, the way kind of that you guys presented it, the announcers, the cheering, the jubilation, and the atmosphere at the games is really captured well. Like you said, you're a former basketball player. Were there ever times where you wanted to put on that uniform and go and play with them?
Definitely. I mean, honestly, these guys, for being a team that never or rarely won, they're good basketball players. They're good. You know, I'd mess around with them in practice, and, you know, they're great. It just shows how serious high school basketball is in Indiana, you know, that even, you know, a team composed of some pretty good players still struggles to win. So I could have thrown a jersey on. Andrew Cohn, my co-director, you know, we would practice with them and scrimmage with them, but I don't know if we could have helped them get a win any better than they did themselves. I can say this, when we would film these close games, we would have, you know, we wanted them to win so badly. Once you get to know these kids and their stories, you just want them to win so badly. We would have tears in our eyes at the end of a close game. We were rooting for them so much, and I'd forget to film. You know, I'd just be like, look, watching the game and cheering, and then I'd snap out of it and, you know, get the camera going again. But the games were really intense, and you know, you see at a, you know, this is a school. It was high school with 60 kids in it, and their gym is the same size as Ann Arbor Pioneer High School's gym, which has like 2,500 students. And so some of these other gyms, when they'd play a school with like 1,000 kids, you know, it was like a college arena, you know. So the communities take it so seriously, and they're just, these games are really intense.
You talk about practicing with the kids and, you know, trying to build strong relationships, you know, to create that intimacy, to get all of, you know, these really great moments that you've captured. What are some other things that you did? Hanging out with them, that sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just spending time, that much time. We were there every day. You know, we didn't leave on the weekends to go. I live in Los Angeles now, and Andrew lives in New York, but you know, we spent every day with them, all day. So, you know, when you're in people's homes, one thing that some people are surprised by when they see the film is just how open and intimate moments you get to see with the kids and their families, and the way that they reveal themselves with such great vulnerability and soulfulness. But I think that when you approach people with genuine kindness and curiosity and, you know, compassion, people are eager to share their stories with you. And it's not that often that somebody asks them, you know, what are their opinions about the world? You know, what do they make of their own life, to have perspective on their own life? So we considered it incredibly open and generous for them to share such personal stories. But also, you know, they seem to enjoy it, really, and be eager at the chance to do that.
By the end of filming, Dylan, were you a little bit tired of having them follow you around everywhere?
Not really. After a couple of weeks, we just forgot the cameras were even there. Mm-hmm. And, like, we just played the game, and we just talked to them as they were one of our closest friends. So the cameras never really got tired. It was actually kind of shocked to see them go sometimes.
If there was one, you know, Dylan and his friends, they got used to us being around all the time with the cameras. But I did notice a couple of times I would, you know, if they were going, whatever they were doing, I was there with the camera. Mm-hmm. Dylan went on a couple of dates when he would go to pick up the girl, and he may not have warned them that a camera crew was going to be there. So I remember them getting into the car and being like, whoa, Dylan, there's a dude in the back seat filming us right now. What's going on?
What was going through their mind?
Yeah.
A little surprise here. Someone else will be joining us tonight. Dylan, how has this film changed your life? Or has it changed your life?
Well, I really haven't been home, so I really haven't really noticed anything. But, like, when I went back to work at IGA, some girl, like, and her mother, like, I knew who they were. And one of my manager, like, she's a manager at night when I'm working. She's like, yeah, he's a movie star. He just came back from California. And she, and the girls go, oh, I recognize you. So my face got really red. So got a little embarrassed.
What have you been doing since that 2011 season that's captured in the film?
I work at a grocery store. I'm going to go back to school. Andrew talked me into it. Well, and I'm pretty much, yeah. But anyways, I'm going to go back to school for music, technology, and second major in something else. But I haven't really decided on that. I'll let that just take place one step at a time.
How has the film changed you? Or how has that experience of being in Medora changed you?
It was one of the most profound experiences of my life, and I know Andrew would say the same thing. We've been doing Found Magazine for years, which is a lot of fun. People find notes and letters on the ground, actual love letters, to-do lists, journal entries, send them in to us from all around the country. And so when you read this, you get an interesting glimpse into another person's life. It's just the tip of the iceberg. And so what was so magical was to be able to go into a story and really spend 8 months there and continue to come back for the year that followed, you know, to go deep, to see the entire iceberg, you know, to see, you know, get to know an entire town and really just get to see the value of these small towns. You know, we went down there with that question in mind, you know, what is lost when these small towns fade off the map? And because there's Medoras all around Michigan. You know, I grew up in Ann Arbor and Ipsy, but 20 minutes any direction, you'll see towns like Medora. They're around Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, the whole Midwest, the Rust Belt, and really all around the country. You know, I live in California now. You see small towns like Medora there. And so, you know, to get to go into a town and just get a sense for the value of a community like that is a powerful thing.
Davey, Dylan, it's been a pleasure speaking with you both.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yep, thank you.
Davey Rothbart is a co-producer and director of the film Medora, and Dylan McSolley is a former Medora High School student and basketball player featured in the film. Medora will be part of WKAR's community cinema event this Thursday. A short preview of the film will be screened, followed by a community panel. More information about the event can be found at WKAR.org. For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
That's our program for today. Tomorrow on Current State, we'll learn about an organization that helps new and underrepresented farmers for our Neighbors in Action segment. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. We hope to see you tomorrow. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR.